The next case this morning is EY et al. Versus United States.
Good morning, Your Honors. This is a case about a child who has serious and permanent brain damage caused by multiple tortfeasors. Those multiple tortfeasors were separated by time, identity, and location. And the evidence in this case, if the case had proceeded past summary judgment phase, would have showed that there were two separate injuries caused at different times, one superimposed upon the other. One of those is what the Drazen Court would call a previous independent cause in the government's control. The district court initially in this case denied a motion to dismiss based on the statute of limitations, finding that the injury during labor and delivery was suggested to this 20-year-old mother early, but nothing was ever suggested or said to her about this earlier potential prenatal injury caused by the clinic. The court specifically distinguished between labor and delivery and the prenatal care, and the district court held that in denying the motion to dismiss, looking at both the subjective and objective grounds for such a motion. That was a reasonable conclusion then, and it's a reasonable conclusion now. What the court went on to do in the subsequent summary judgment motion was to take essentially the same facts and instead of looking at the time the clinic records were received, which was what it used to determine the issue of statute of limitations in the motion to dismiss, it used, with a 17-day differential, the time that those clinic records had been requested. Now, we submit that this is a government cause that turned out to be an omission once those records were received in terms of the facts, that a reasonable person under those circumstances could not have even suspected until at least some of those records were received. And in fact, the district court concluded that in denying the motion to dismiss, and that's the December 1406 date.
The time for ran based on the request rather than the receipt.
The time on the summary judgment ruling ran based on the request rather than receipt, which is a 17-day differential. And we submit with all due respect to the district court that that's not logical based on the previous findings the court made. The court also determined that requesting in the denial of the motion to dismiss, the court had essentially decided and determined that requesting records of the clinic did not automatically trigger a suspicion of the clinic that would trigger the statute of limitations. There was a line drawn there by the district court. So we get to the summary judgment motion, and the district court, first of all, I want to be clear a couple things here, concluded the same thing it had concluded before with the difference of the request records versus not request, receiving records, and found under the summary judgment motion that anything involving the discussion with the uncle, who was also a lawyer, who was not a specialist in this business, did not trigger the statute of limitations. The court also found that anything that the plaintiff, this 20-year-old girl, knew up to the point in time that the records were requested of the clinic did not trigger the statute of limitations. That was one thing that was consistent in both of the rulings. But what the court did then, the court specifically rejected this notion that somehow because she was in community college, where the suggestion by the government is she's a nursing student, which the court completely rejected in a footnote, that made her somehow have superior knowledge that would trigger this earlier. The court rejected that both times. Now, what the court did here is, and the court was clear about this, the court considered this a case of first impression. And a first impression in the sense that there is no guiding law from the Seventh Circuit or the Supreme Court where there are multiple tortfeasors, one of whom is a government defendant, where you have these events separated by time, identity, and location. All the previous case law involved a biological cause and a government cause. And so the court, in fashioning what was essentially a new rule, came up with this, the quote, you should suspect the potential universe of treatment providers at any time there's an event like this and any time you request records. The problem with that is it's not compatible with the existing case law, in particularly in the Seventh Circuit, about looking at the subjective and objective analyses, and it's not compatible with cases that have specifically required a finding that the government cause was suspected or should have been suspected as opposed to any other cause. And so what we now have is a rejection of this entire circuit's body of case law about the we're not supposed to be paranoid and ghoulish, and we're not supposed to scour records anytime there's a bad outcome and then sue everybody in sight. This rule now would require, in this case, in a situation like this, that you get all the records, you sue everybody and ask questions.
Well, not exactly. You've got 2 years, right?
Correct.
To investigate.
Correct.
And why is that unreasonable in this sort of situation where you've got, I mean, look, the relationship between prenatal care and delivery.
Mm. Well, I go back to, with all due respect, Judge, the district court twice, in the motion to dismiss, considered there was a distinction between prenatal and delivery.
That.
And I think that was a reasonable conclusion, and could reasonable people differ about that? That could be, but this is a summary judgment. That's an inference that could be drawn either way, and those inferences have to be construed in favor of the plaintiffs under this situation. And as far as the 2 years is concerned, you know, without belaboring the facts, I'm sure your honors are very familiar with the timeline here, is that the records were requested, I believe, on the December 4th or thereabouts, and I might be off a few days, but there was a 17-day period in which those records then came in. And if you use the date the records came in, this case was timely filed. If you use the date they were requested, it wasn't timely filed. And the district court found initially that there was no trigger of suspicion until you got the records. There was no information. What happened here is this. What was told to this young woman who's had her first child is that something happened in the labor and delivery that caused oxygen deprivation to her baby. Nobody ever said anything about the clinic in a remote time and place of different people and different events. It's reinforced to her by Dr. Thornton, the physical medicine doctor, early in the following year, says exactly the same thing and specifically puts in her records there was no problem with the prenatal care. Mm-hmm. Then she talks to her uncle.
Dr. Thornton base that on?
What did she base that on?
Yes.
Well, you know, her deposition was never taken. This is what she put in her medical records. I can tell you, I know Dr. Thornton from other matters. She's a physical medicine and rehabilitation doctor who does give opinions in terms of when she thinks and a brain injury occurred. So that's something she does sometimes and doesn't do other times. But that's just what the record said. So we only know what the records say. Then the plaintiff talks to her uncle and conveys to him the same information and with nothing changing about what she's been told about the labor and delivery, and he says she might have a case. He doesn't say the prenatal records. She doesn't have anything about the prenatal care. And then she comes to the Clifford Law offices, and then the records are requested with you know, her conveying the same information. I was told labor and delivery, there was a problem with oxygen. The records get ordered. 17 days later, they come in. If you use the date that the records came in, this case was timely filed. Now, the fact that...
Counsel, if I could interrupt.
I'm sorry,
let's go back to the standard that you are articulating here in terms of... And the government seems to be saying if you've got reason to suspect any medical care provider, you've got reasonable to suspect all of them.
Right.
And the clock is running. You're saying you want us to apply a standard that says not if you've got separate time, place, and identity, right?
Well, I think every case is fact specific, and in this case,
we got to say something. That's
okay,
more general.
I think that's part of the. You have to look at that, the temporal relationship of the various actors.
Well, do you need all three to be different? Do you think?
No, I think you could just have one. It could just be one.
So, same doctor, different times?
No, if it's the same doctor, then if it's a government defendant, then you've got that. It wouldn't be.
So you
got to
have
identity. Wouldn't be.
You got to have separate identity.
It could be a different. It would have to be a different actor.
Separate
number
identity.
Number one, and it would have to be at least a separate date or a separate location.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd say the date and actor would be probably the most important.
If the problem's involved in a surgery. Everybody who's in the room.
Separate location.
Correct.
Raises the idea about video. And much of that being done by video, too. Mm-hmm.
Right.
So you end up with not the same location, but...
Right.
But linked, so... Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So we submit, Your Honors, that with all due respect to the district court, this rule that was created in this case, it doesn't exist anywhere else in the law, that by definition, if you order medical records from a provider or a couple of providers in order to investigate this case, that as a matter of law, that means that you suspect everybody you ordered records from. That's not the law, and that shouldn't be the law. And we believe that the motion for summary judgment should be reversed. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel.
May it please the Court and Counsel. All of these events that I'm going to describe right now happened more than 2 years before she filed suit. And that's relevant because if she suspected a doctor-related cause during any of these events, her claim is time barred. First, she left the hospital. She saw the impaired condition of her child.
Well, Mr. Lindland, are you trying to argue that the district court started the clock too late by focusing on the production or on the request for documents?
What we're saying is that certainly by the time she speaks with her uncle lawyer and then goes to a malpractice lawyer, meets with them at least three times, then requests medical records, by then her claim is definitely accrued. It probably accrued well before that, but you don't have to figure that out. Because by the time she goes to her medical malpractice lawyers at the Clifford Law Firm, which is one of the most prominent plaintiff's firms in the city, and they request medical records, the claim is easily accrued.
Well, everybody agrees she had reason to... the claim is accrued with respect to the University of Chicago Medical Center and its staff, or the hospital. So I guess the question that I have is, maybe I'm misunderstanding this, but your rule seems to be pretty absolute. That is, once you're on inquiry notice about one iatrogenic cause, then you're on notice for any other potential iatrogenic causes. Is that right?
I think that is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Has any court adopted that rule?
And I think all the cases, most of the cases we cite talk about suspecting a doctor-related cause.
None of the cases you cite describe separate medical care providers. The cases don't win, the precedents don't win the case for you.
The cases that are cited are all, well, most of them relate only to government doctors.
Biological causes versus
correct.
Negligent causes.
Exactly.
Right. And that really doesn't solve this problem.
I mean, I'm sorry, go ahead and answer that.
We believe it does. The cases that are cited, the Seventh Circuit cases we cite, talk about suspecting a doctor-related cause.
None of those cases considered this kind of problem.
That's correct.
There's language each of you can flog. I don't blame you for doing so. But it's a draw, okay, as far as those prior cases go. For this problem, separate channels of health care delivery.
It is true that none of those cases include a private doctor and a government doctor to draw that distinction.
Who are working independently of each other.
Right.
Yeah, okay. So why should we adopt the rule that you're arguing?
Because if you don't, you'll have a statute of limitations that will start depending on when a plaintiff finds out or suspects that an anesthesiologist or a nurse or a lab technician or some other doctor had anything to do with it. And you'd have different statute of limitations starting for each of these individuals, which is, that's unworkable. And it's not.
Well, if I understand the plaintiff's position, let's say something has gone wrong in an operation. Then I think it would be pretty obvious if you've got reason to suspect there was negligence in the operation, the clock is running as to everybody involved in that, right? But that goes back to what the plaintiff was talking about. Do we have identity of, or a unity? It's almost like Aristotelian drama. Do we have a unity of time, place, and identity here, as opposed to different channels? If we ask for records, the clock is running against us.
There may be a case like that, but in these cases, these birth injury cases, everyone knows there's the prenatal clinic and there's the hospital. And they work together. It's one process to accomplish the birth of the child. And so
it doesn't... My question to you, I understand where you're going with that. My question to you is, what about physical location? Suppose she lived in California, had her prenatal work done there, come to Chicago. There's no connection, I mean, other than the normal medical connection.
Right, but if there's a bad outcome or there's something wrong with the birth, she goes and hires a lawyer. They all know to look at the prenatal records. They're going to ask her, where did you go for your prenatal care? And they're going to get those records, just like they do in this case. In fact, this is a perfect example. When they requested medical records, they requested them from the hospital and the clinic at the same time. There's a reason for that. It's because they suspected each of those as a cause of the injury. And more importantly, they requested those records more than 2 years before suit was filed. And that means her claim is time-barred. Unless the court has further questions, we ask that you affirm the decision of the district court.
Well, thanks, both. I'm sorry.
Well, I, at the risk of just making the rhetorical point, but I guess Judge Gettleman thought the inference was reasonable at the summary at the motion to dismiss stage, and then concludes it's not reasonable at the summary judgment stage. Seems to be the same inference.
There are a few things that are different. First, of course, the standard of review is much different. The second,
not really with respect to this question. That is it reasonable to infer from the request for records that the plaintiff is on inquiry notice with respect to the clinic?
Well, in part, but remember there were new facts that were developed.
What are new facts?
She spoke with her uncle twice, who's an attorney, who told her she might have a case, which a reasonable person would suspect they might have a case, which means they suspect
that. Well, that much is assumed. As that much is assumed with respect to the request directed to the hospital, right?
Right, but there's also three new cases that came out after the motion to dismiss: Arroyo, Arteaga, and AQC. And especially the AQC case is remarkably close to this because the plaintiff sought legal counsel, and the court there said, once you go to a lawyer, you have suspected that there's a doctor-related cause before you went to the lawyer. Otherwise, you wouldn't have gone to that lawyer. In this case, she talked to her uncle lawyer twice, then waited several months because she didn't want to get involved in a lawsuit, and then decided to go to the trial lawyers at the Clifford Law Office, met with them at least once, then twice to sign a retainer agreement, waive her privacy rights to her medical records, and then her medical malpractice lawyers requested medical records. I mean, obviously, they are suspecting a doctor-related cause at that point. Like I said before, you don't have to go back in time and figure out exactly when the claim occurred, because at the point they request the medical records, that's more than 2 years from the date they filed their lawsuit. Unless the court has further questions, we ask that you affirm the decision of the district court.
Thank you, counsel. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement and removed.